Hey there, this is Love Your Work. The whole point of this show is to help you make it as a creative entrepreneur. And I am David Cadavy. I am an author, I'm a designer. And here on this show, I have interviewed industry titans like Steve Case. I've interviewed authors like Seth Godin and James Altucher. I've interviewed creators from dancers to a chef to a Hollywood set designer, visionaries on the cutting edge of creative monetization, whether that be self-publishing or blockchain technology. And the whole idea here, the thing that I want to do is I want to pull out lessons from these conversations, and I want to help you find your unique voice as a creative entrepreneur. I want to help you really nail the right mindset to succeed moving forward. I want to help you be the first to capitalize on new opportunities to make a living doing your creative work. So if you're new here, welcome again. I am David Cadavy. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, just hit subscribe on your podcast app. And by the way, I also have a great creative productivity toolkit. It tells you a little bit about the tools that I have used to quadruple my creative output. You can sign up for that at cadavy.net/tools. Steve Stewart, who we are talking to today, was the manager of the band Stone Temple Pilots. He guided them from being an unknown funk band to a multi-platinum powerhouse whose sound is synonymous with 90s grunge. Now, with Steve by STP's side, they sold over 25 million records, nearly $500 million in sales. Then the internet happened, and the record industry wasn't really selling many CDs or records anymore, and fans were starting to become a bigger part of helping music spread, and it turned out that free music was key to this new success equation. So Steve had to stand by helplessly as big music industry players sort of shot themselves in the foot, and then they started tightening their budgets in the process. So now Steve is trying to fill in the gap that free music created. So imagine that Justin Bieber paid you. With Steve's new company, that could actually become true. Steve is now CEO of a company called Vezt, that is V-E-Z-T. With Vezt, music fans like you can buy a share of the future earnings of a song. So if you're a Justin Bieber fan, you could at some point buy a share of his song, and then Justin Bieber would pay you money. Now, in case you happen to be wondering, you can't short a song. These aren't stocks that you're buying. You're buying a share of future royalties. So we're going to learn more about how all this works in today's conversation. So find out, what artistic decisions did Stone Temple Pilots have to make in order to become the huge success that they were? I had to pick Steve's brain on this. We really took him back to the early days, and we find out why early 90s music critics are now calling him to apologize. And how does Vezt fill in the hole that music sharing created? The fans have become a part of the music promotion process, and with Vezt, they'll start getting a piece of the pie that they deserve. Also, blockchain companies are really hot now, but the blockchain is not always relevant to every business model. Now, what is it about blockchain technology that makes Vezt possible? By the way, Love Your Work is now 100% listener supported. You might have heard me mention that on earlier episodes. That means that our Patreon supporters are donating enough to cover the cost of producing the episodes and delivering the audio files to you. So if you see one of our Patreon supporters on the street, then that's actually kind of strange that you know what they look like, because there's not like a gallery or something of Patreon supporters where you can see their faces. Maybe we should have that. I don't know. But for the time being, if you are psychic and you happen to see one of our Patreon supporters, be sure to tell that person thank you. This show truly could not go on without them. Now, why is it that these people pay for this show when they could just listen to it for free? I asked Edlin, who is one of the newest supporters, and she said, "I am supporting you because I think the work you're doing is important. To me, it's less about being able to listen to the content and more about finding ways to show up for you, if only in a small way. I've tried making the independent creator thing work, went back to work full-time jobs because I found it lonely and had more to learn, but don't think that I'm too far from doing it again. People like you make the process feel less independent." So if you are an aspiring independent creator like Edlin, if this show helps you, if you enjoy having me right there with you on this journey, then please support the show. I often find that wherever I put my money, that ends up being where I put my attention. So it's actually a really good way to remind yourself that you really want to make it as a creator. So join up, go to cadavy.net/donate. That is cadavy.net/donate. Here is Steve Stewart. time here with Steve Stewart. And Steve, I think one of the things that's really going to stand out to people is that you were the personal manager of Stone Temple Pilots. So what does being a personal manager entail in the music industry?
Well, I like to say it's everything except writing and performing. So it's back in the day, this is, you know, mid-90s, you basically handled all the business aspects. So I was responsible for securing the record deal for them, bringing in the lawyers, bringing in the booking agents, putting the tours together, helping them produce the music videos, working with the label, also handling their business as far as finances. I got them a business manager, helped them, you know, get investment managers, that type of thing. So you're kind of the quarterback. It's like the CEO of a company, right? It's the same kind of thing. They're the actual engine that writes and creates and performs. And then you're the one that helps put that into business sense. So you're doing everything from replacing, you know, lost ATM cards at 4 a.m. to chartering a jet for a tour to hiring, you know, 40 people to staff that tour and then working the label to make sure that the records are being pushed out properly and promoted properly and distributed properly.
And you were with them from the time that they did their demo as the band Mighty Joe Young, and then they later changed their name to Stone Temple Pilots. And if you listen to that demo with when they're Mighty Joe Young, there's really some funk elements to the band. And it seems like when they really exploded on the mainstream scene, they were a lot more defined in terms of sound. So I'm wondering, as a manager, is that at all part of your job, is helping make creative decisions like that? Like, hey, we're going to tone down the funk part of this and we're going to go in this other direction?
Well, David, you did your homework. I'm impressed. I was a drummer in a band, and my band was a sister band with a band called Soi Disant. And that band became Mighty Joe Young. And that band, I got signed to Atlantic Records in 1992. And then we did change the name to Stone Temple Pilots. So historically, that's that part. As far as what you do with, you know, the sound of the band, you know, you help guide them. I would credit Robert DeLeo, the bass player for the band, for finding a producer named Brendan O'Brien. And he said, Steve, there's this up and coming producer named Brendan O'Brien. Let's get him. And that's all he said to me. And I went out and found, he was Rick Rubin's protege. He had just finished a record, I think, for Uncle Green, his first record where he was a producer. And we did recognize, and you're very astute to see that funk. That demo is very LA 1989, right? It was the Chili Peppers in their original funk glory. It was Fishbone. There was a lot of acts out here that were very much in that same street funk kind of groove. And Stone Temple Pilots, or Mighty Joe Young at that point, you're right, was very much like that. And if you do listen to that demo, I'm not sure how you got it, but it is available on cassette somewhere, was very funky. And I think bringing in Brendan, who was a guitar player and was the guy that actually did the Hard to Handle solo for the Georgia Satellites back in the day, very rock influenced, Southern rock specifically. And the DeLeo brothers, Dean and Robert, the guitar player and the bass player, were from New Jersey. So they were a very heavily rock-influenced couple of artists. Scott and Eric, the other two members, were West Coast guys and much more alternative, new wavy. But I think Brendan brought out a lot of guitar-oriented stuff and made the band have a lot more depth, in my opinion, than a lot of what was happening in LA at that point. So he brought in a very Southern rock sensibility, a lot more guitar oriented stuff, which I thought was more melodic. And I thought, you know, gave the band a level of depth that wasn't so common. It was also the era, obviously, of Pearl Jam, Nirvana, and Soundgarden, and the Seattle sound. And I think he was very masterful as far as mirroring what was happening in the rock genre and getting kind of out of that very LA style that was very popular in this town at that point. And made something that I thought was very commercially accessible. So, yeah, I mean, you put those tools together, you bring the resources to bear, and you help kind of guide the artist to what ultimately they want. But part of my job is making them commercially successful. So I'm always looking for, you know, what works in the marketplace, what works with what's happening now, where are trends going, whereas sometimes the artist is heads down, you know, in a certain location or style or vibe or place. in time, and they're not looking above and looking beyond. But I think, you know, bringing in Brendan was a very, very pivotal point in bringing success to the band.
And is it hard for an artist to, I mean, was it difficult to get them to say, okay, we're gonna not do this funk element anymore? Is that something that they held on to? Did they resist to changing that?
No, actually, you know, surprisingly, not at all. And I think they welcomed someone, again, a guitar player extraordinaire. Brendan's a very, very adept player. And I think that gave them a huge, you know, respect for him immediately. So when they heard the difference between, you know, the demo to the actual album, I think they were really overjoyed. And as you're referencing the demo, there's a track called Where the River Goes on that demo that to me actually sounds better on the demo than it does on the album. And I guess I'll say that again, but that song was pretty much how it was, very uninfluenced by external forces. So if you want to hear how that original part came out of the band in say the late 80s and then how it got from that into the 1992 release of Core, the first album, that song pretty much carried over from a lot of what you're saying. It wasn't completely funk. It was much more of a deep, you know, rock and roll groove, very guitar based, deep grooving rock track. But I think that song in particular was one of the remnants from the demo that rang pretty true to form. There's another song called Spanish Fly. This is going back, man, David, you're making me go back, but it was very funky in that song. And a couple other songs were morphed together. I think they took a chorus from that and turned it into, I don't know, one of the other songs on the record. It's interesting, but they respected the innovation. They respected the input. They respected the creativity and expertise of Brendan when he came in. And I think that openness really led them to, you know, making 1+1=3.
What I heard, there were renditions of Creep and Plush on. Were those on the original demo as well? Because they sounded almost like they did on Core.
Wow, you're excellent. They were on the demo. I can't remember Creep specifically. Plush, it may have been called something else, but elements of all those songs, like I said, they were pulling choruses and they were pulling, you know, a verse over here. They would pull certain lines from certain songs on the demo and then either consolidate them into a new song or rename it and put them back out. But a lot of those elements in the original demos made it through. They just sounded a little more rock, alt rock versus, you know, the funk that you mentioned earlier.
Well, and it's amazing to think that this demo is late 80s. And then when Stone Temple Pilots became more popular, I think the critics were a little tough on them for, accusing them of sounding like Pearl Jam, when in fact, a lot of this was happening way before most people knew who Pearl Jam was. Was that something that you noticed?
Man, you are spot on. This is bringing back memories. They were very critical. I mean, as an example, I'm not sure the year, the Rolling Stone reader poll versus the critic poll, right? They were at the top of the reader poll and they were at the bottom of the critic poll. So we got hit really hard with a lot of press saying that, you know, they sounded a lot like Pearl Jam or Soundgarden. Scott, the lead singer, who's passed away a couple of years ago now, he took it really hard. You know, there was a critic named Jonathan Gold who was a music critic back then. And I know he's a big food critic now, but he said something that was very, you know, disparaging and addressed Scott personally versus criticizing the music, which I took him to task. And I said, look, you can criticize music all you want, but to wish somebody was gone probably isn't, you know, within the purview of a music critic. And they were hit pretty hard. So that hit them really, really in a tough way. As an example, that, you know, Rolling Stone offered their cover, I think, in 94, and it took about 3 years. I don't think we had the cover until 97 because the band was gun shy. They were like, you know, they're just going to chop us up. They're going to feed us to the lions if we do a story with them. And it took me about 3 years and a call from Jan Wenner himself to help work things out. And I said, Jan, you know, we'd love to be in your magazine, but the band's afraid of what you guys are going to write because you had some very bad things to say in the early reviews. And he, you know, did his best to reassure me. And I said, is there something we can do? Or maybe you send me your top writer and I will introduce them personally to the band and develop a relationship. And then at that point, if they're comfortable, they can do a story, which is what we did. We met David Frick, who is an amazing writer and was a senior editor at that time. And they were trying to, Jan was asking him to run the magazine, but David was such a purist. He's like, I don't want a business to run. I want to be a music writer. And he was a very, very astute and very, very knowledgeable music critic. And I had dinner with him, and then I had introduced him to the band separately. And they all gave him the thumbs up and were very impressed with him. And I think when he wrote that cover story, I believe it was 97, he did a very, I'll just call it transparent. It's again, it's fine to criticize. It's just when a writer has a particular angle, sometimes it becomes, you know, just a little too deep. But David was great. And I think the band really appreciated and respected the work that he did. So they took a lot of that criticism very harshly. But like you mentioned, they've been playing music from, you know, years ago. And honestly, as you may know, musicians that grow up in the same era have sometimes the same references, right? You know, when I was growing up, the Beatles were a big deal, the Rolling Stones. I mean, there's a lot of artists that you listen to when you're learning how to play your instrument, and those become your influences when you write. And to find that it's surprising that there's a group of bands from 1992 that sound similar isn't that much of a stretch for me. But, you know, they took it pretty hard on the chin from a lot of critics at that point.
Well, and in contrast to that early criticism, it seems like the music has stood the test of time in the eyes of critics. Do you think that that's accurate?
It is. And I've had a number of calls and emails from critics over the years that apologize. It said, look, you know, I wrote this band off initially, but when I really listen to the music and listen to how it's evolved over the, you know, 5 or 7 records they made, they go, you know, I'm sorry, this is good stuff. And I got caught up in the, you know, in the wave of whatever it was that had people banding together. But I think anyone that listens, you know, will see that there's depth there. The evolution amongst the albums from Core, you know, all the way through to number 4 specifically, I think is something that you'll see in most artists that have depth. They're not just writing the same song over and over and over. There's a lot of melodies that were there. There's a lot of references that are pulled from other genres of music. And I think the personal growth and the artistic growth that the band shared together in those days is pretty much recorded right then and there. And it's, you know, it is tough for a band. They call it the sophomore slump sometimes, and it applies across sports and a lot of other analogies. But to come out with a second record that is, you know, as impressive as the first artistically, in my opinion, and that second record obviously charted at number 1 in 1994. So I think they had a fan base by then that respected that, and people knew. I mean, if you were a fan of any kind of rock in the mid-90s, I think you're familiar with Stone Temple Pilots.
And we've talked about the sophomore slump on this show with a previous musician that we spoke to. Was that something that the band was talking about or thinking about as they were on the cusp of releasing that second album?
You know, it wasn't a conscious topic of conversation, but I think following up a record that did as well as Core, their first album, I think at that point when we were writing it, they were writing it was probably, I don't know, coming through 4 or 5 million units. Which was a big number back then and still today. And the second album was written, you know, basically while they were on tour. And your first album, you've got years and years. I mean, since you've learned how to play a guitar or drums or what have you, you've got all those years up until you release that first album to fine tune and polish and rewrite and create. But when the first album comes out, you know, I think it came out in September of 92. The second album came out in June of 94. So you have about a 20-month period. And some of that is taken up with, you know, doing the artwork and videos and promotion. So it wasn't like you had 2 years to write an album. You had maybe, I don't know, you know, maybe 12 months. But in those months was a lot of promotional and touring behind the first record. So the first record, again, you've got your lifetime to come up with it. The second record, you've got, you know, maybe 8 months tops to have it recorded and completed. So in that environment, when you're on the road and being mobile. And again, these are times before, you know, before a lot of email, before a lot of the tools that are available to artists today. You couldn't just have a Pro Tools rig sitting on your bus somewhere. It didn't exist in 1993 or 1994. So there were a lot of technological barriers to the ease of recording and production that a lot of artists have today. And it wasn't so much thinking about how do we top it. It was thinking about how do we get more music out? How do we get things out in a timely manner while we're still on top of promoting the first record? And I will say, you know, that first record success was like being shot through a cannon. It was crazy. The band didn't have an independent record deal. They didn't have a career really prior to that first album on Atlantic Records. So we were playing catch up in many senses. You know, the amount of publicity and promotion and marketing that we had to do behind that record to make it successful was enormous. And Schedules were stretched. It was hard. And an artist, it's like when people watch models or they're saying, oh, she does this, she goes to photo shoots. Well, there's a lot more to it than that. You know, people go, oh, all he has to do is write a song and then perform it. Well, there's a lot that goes into writing that song, getting it recorded and produced properly, and getting it distributed and marketed and promoted properly. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes that adds a lot of time and effort and stress to that process. And I stand amazed that the band could pull that together in that period of time and have such high quality product come out of it, and songs that, you know, ring true and, like you said, probably stand the test of time through today.
Yeah, when you do describe that of there being a 2-year gap between the first album and the second, and all of I want to use the word hype, but that's like the wrong word. But all of the media frenzy going on, like, I can only imagine what that does to one's self-perception, not to mention adjusting to life on the road and traveling a lot and doing all these things to maintain the career, yet at the same time being able to reach in and get some authentic music out again. It seems impossible. Do you have any insight at all into how they manage that?
Well, I think for the most part, they stayed true to themselves. Again, there weren't a lot of distractions that you have today. There was no YouTube. There was no mobile phone usage at the level that it is today. There was no texting. There wasn't, a million things to do online. So in some sense, but in particular, Robert, the bass player, he's very focused, right? I mean, his favorite artists are like Mel Torme. I mean, he's interested in the quality of the craftsmanship of the music itself and less about the hype. I think, it's fair to say Scott, the lead singer, was very public and a fashion plate and was out there, in the scene. But the other three members of the band, I think, were very true to themselves, what they always enjoyed about music and writing music and playing the type of music that they wanted to. So they were anchored pretty solidly. And the front guy's out there selling it and doing what he has to do to make it popular and being in the press. But the engine of the band, that locomotive that drives it, those guys were they're very consistent. And I think that helped them because it's a crazy thing to try to relate to somebody. Not many people have gone through that type of machine where you jump on the platform and it starts going supersonic. And before you know it, there's like 6 million records out there, and you go from playing opening for somebody in a club or a bar to headlining in front of 20,000 people in the period of, 12 months. That's a crazy ride.
It sounds like there were a lot of complementary personalities and attributes of the various band members, which is something that we've talked about on this show, and I think helps make it a good team. Now, when you were with STP as their manager, I think you sold 25 million records, more than half a billion in revenues. Would you consider that period of time was a particularly good period of time to be in the music business?
I mean, I consider that the last hurrah of the major labels, right? I mean, if you look at the history of the industry, the biggest portion of commercialism occurred, right before 2000, right before Napster came in. And it was the ability of the labels to not only do vinyl, but then do cassette tapes and then do CDs. They were basically selling the same record 3 times. So the margins got bigger and bigger and bigger. For example, one of the caveats in our deals with the labels at that point were we couldn't release a single. They didn't want singles to come out. They wanted people to buy the entire $18.99 CD because their profit margin was much higher on that than it was on a $1.99 single. So there were a lot of methods and formulas in place for the actual, business side, the record labels, to capitalize heavily. And they were. I mean, those were the last days of what I would call the excesses of the music business. And we saw some crazy times. I mean, there were, big staffs, private jets. I mean, it was everything that you think it would have been in the stories and tales that you hear. And that's changed now. I mean, after the advent of Napster, after these labels were cut down at the knees, they're much more lean. They're much more efficient now. And I think they operate with a different ethos than they did, say, in 1995 or 1997. It was a different time.
Yeah, I mean, they were basically selling the media. They were selling it in these different formats, and people were buying it because that's the way they needed to. That's what they needed to do to be able to listen to the music. And then things changed, and it became, well, hey, we have intellectual property still, but people are sharing it all over the place with something like Napster. Can you describe what was it like for you as somebody in the music business, making your living off of people buying the music that you're managing, and then suddenly seeing it shared all over the internet for free?
It was crazy. And I specifically remember a meeting in 1997 where the first time I ever saw the CFO of the company come in, Atlantic Records, into a budget meeting. And I said, who's that? And they said, oh, that's the CFO. And I said, well, what's he doing there? And they said, well, he's going to look over all the expenditures. And prior to that, it had been, you know, you guys made us X millions of dollars, you know, and we were very frugal with record budgets. We didn't overspend on videos or tour support or anything like that. But that was, to me, the first part of the corporatization, if you want to call it that, of the music business. And then as Napster came in 2000, that went away very quickly. And I had a chance to speak with, you know, the guys that ran Napster back in the day, and they weren't there to like hurt anybody. In fact, they took meetings to partner with these labels, and they said, look, we have this technology. We want to work with you guys. And the label said, we're going to sue you. And the horses were already out of the barn. When you release a CD, that is a digital master of that recording that anybody can take and copy. So they took a very adversarial and a litigious stance against it, which they know now, an entity which they should have partnered with and basically exploited with, but they didn't. And that mistake cost them dearly. And it really, I think it divided some of the artists. I mean, there were a number of artists that thought, hey, you know what? We want to have our fans get our stuff. The label had been, you know, a pretty tight gatekeeper for a long time, and many artists didn't get the opportunity to connect with their fans, right? Labels, they controlled your websites, they controlled your video channels, they controlled a lot of the things that most people don't understand, but they wanted to control that stuff. And with the advent of digital distribution, artists could open up a YouTube channel, they could open up a stream to get their songs out digitally to their fans directly around the label. So there were a number of artists that were interested in doing that. And there were some other artists on the other side, like Metallica, for instance, that said, look, we don't want to have you doing this, and we think that it's thievery, and we're gonna sue everybody. We're gonna pursue, you know, legal action against people. And I don't know if they actually sued their fans, but at some point there was a threat of that. So it was polarizing, I think, to the industry at that point. And I could see, you know, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. By that point, when people are just pushing a hard drive on you with 4,000 songs, I saw where it was going. You know, you can't go backwards and say, hey, we're going to charge $18.99 again. No, I just got 4,000 songs for free. Why am I paying $20? So I think it was easy for some people to look at. Being in it at the time, it was a very polarizing event. I saw the labels get decimated. They were walking around like their head just got blown off. And a lot of artists, you know, saw opportunity, but really couldn't capitalize on it at that point. They still had no real structure. And even today, there's still, you know, a dearth of structures to independently monetize their work. And I think that probably has led to where we are today and has taken the labels down a notch as far as artist development and monetizing, you know, content to the point that they really can.
It's funny that that timing kind of works out with the rise of a lot of indie labels. We had Tim Kasher from Cursive and The Good Life on from Saddle Creek Records, who were a group of friends in Omaha, Nebraska, that put together bands like Bright Eyes and The Faint and gained global attention, in part thanks to a lot of the same tools that were simultaneously destroying the larger labels.
It's ironic, right? But that's exactly what was happening. I think there was an opportunity for a lot of artists that have been kept down or kept out by those labels. And the ones that had a lot of success, a la Metallica, saw this as a threat. So it was a double-edged sword. You're right.
We're going to take a quick break. If you want to be great at running your small business, you have to focus. But the pesky details make it hard to focus. If you have to worry about payroll and benefits for your employees, you can't focus. Do you want to spend your time learning the ins and outs of taxes and regulations when you could be running your business? I know I don't. Gusto makes payroll and benefits a breeze. 9 out of 10 users say Gusto is easier to use than other payroll services. 72% of Gusto customers say they finish their payroll in less than 5 minutes, and they have fewer errors. This must be why PC Mag gave Gusto their Editor's Choice Award. PC Mag said, "Gusto is excellent enough that it might make paying your employees an enjoyable experience." Look, you don't have to be a big company anymore to get great technology, great benefits, and great service for your team. Gusto does all of that for you. So to help support the show, Gusto is offering our listeners an exclusive, limited-time deal. Sign up today and you'll get 3 months free once you run your first payroll. Just go to gusto.com/loveyourwork. That's gusto.com/loveyourwork. So what are some of the ways that the model has changed in the music business now that it's more difficult to sell CDs or vinyl? How have labels reacted to that, and what decisions have they made that have worked, and what didn't work?
Well, I think the biggest decision was they came with what's called a 360 deal. So when they realized that the masters themselves, the actual sound recordings, weren't going to pay the bills anymore, they said, well, we've got to monetize this somehow. What can we get? So they went after touring, which they knew was big money. They went after merchandising, which they knew was also a very valid income stream. And they also went after publishing. So those, prior to 2000, those things were held separately from a record deal. And an artist could monetize on their own on the road. They could monetize from their publishing and copyright. And they can also monetize from their merchandise separate from the actual record label. But after the advent of Napster, you saw 360 deals. They're still very, very common. Unless you've got enough clout to carve out something, or you're an artist that maybe, you know, has a fan base that exists, or you've already got a publishing deal, or some of your merchandising might be locked up somewhere, they're going to try to get those income streams on the table because it's one of the few ways they can monetize directly. What you've also seen in the landscape is, you know, YouTube. You've seen a lot of distribution platforms come up that really cost nothing. I mean, Spotify, iTunes, YouTube, Pandora, Deezer, there's a number of platforms where artists can get on for basically free. There's no problem making your songs and music available to people. The vocal part of that is tough. You know, how do you drive people to discover you? How do you, you know, raise your head above the 40 million songs that are out there? That's become much more difficult. So the promotion and marketing is still very valid. But the actual tools to production, with Pro Tools and, you know, Launchpad, and there's a lot of other products that are on the market that allow artists to create very inexpensively. You can do a legitimate record in your bedroom, and a number of people have done that. So the actual production and distribution barriers have come down due to technology to almost zero. I think the biggest one, and it's something that I'm addressing in the project I'm doing now, is monetization. Right? Where's a way for an artist to actually make a living from their craft? And that's become more and more difficult, where major labels are now looking for grand slam home runs. And should they? That's kind of their business model, is we want pop hits. And they're geared towards, you know, selling 10 million units and having 100 million streams. They're not really geared to develop an artist from zero. They're not looking for, you know, a local artist that might have 10,000 fans or even 100,000 fans. They want people that have sway over millions and millions of people at a time. So they've kind of gentrified that in a sense, where a lot of the smaller artists are now floating around without an option. And they're looking for ways to make, you know, like I said, a meaningful living.
Yeah, it does make sense that the bigger labels, they don't want to, you know, curate the artist from the beginning. And as a result, there's a lot more independent artists making a living as musicians. From Tyler Cowen's book, which one is it? From one of Tyler Cowen's book, an economist, he says, in 2014, over 60,000 Americans reported their primary occupation as musician, music director, or composer, up from 53,000 in 1999. So in percentage terms, that's a bigger rise than for the American job market as a whole. So more and more, you know, smaller musicians are independently making a living, while the big labels are starting to have some problems. So your new project is Vez, which it sounds like you can buy a share of the proceeds from a particular song. Can you talk a little bit about Vez and what are the problems that it's trying to solve?
Sure. Vest, first of all, it's an app. We're choosing to base it on a mobile app. Yeah, it's pronounced like V-E-S-T, except it's V-E-Z-T.co.
Makes sense.
A little plug there. But it really is a way for people to buy a piece of their favorite song. And we realize the power of that, right? So I know from personal experience, and I know a lot of artists that know this, when you hear your song on the radio, or you hear your song streamed somewhere, you hear it in a club, or you hear somebody else playing it somewhere, just to know that you share in a little bit of income, whether it's 10 cents or 5 cents or a half of a cent or $10, whatever that number is, every time someone is sharing or playing that music somewhere, you're earning something. It's a very, very powerful feeling to have. And we thought, what's the best way to put somebody in control, right? What's the best, where's the biggest marketplace? It's your fans. Who's going to have a bigger budget for you, the fan or the label, right? A label might give you a $2 million advance, but that pales, right? If you're someone who's, say, a K-pop artist, you have 10 million fans and they each decide to put a dollar in, you've now done a 5X on what the biggest label might have offered you. So we look at it akin to what happened in the financial markets here in the States in the late 80s, right? I mean, before 1988, I believe, you had to be an institutional buyer to buy any number of stock shares, right? Everything was geared towards B2B. It was all other banks, other hedge funds, other funds buying parts of other funds, pension companies, et cetera, insurance companies, et cetera. It wasn't geared towards the consumer on the street. And then you had Charles Schwab and you had E-Trade and you had a lot of the digital platforms start to break out in the late 80s. And all of a sudden, stock trading and investing became a consumer-friendly endeavor, right? You see all these channels pop up, MSNBC, Mad Money, Fox Business, whatever. All those TV channels aren't geared towards pension fund managers or institutions. They're geared toward the public. They're geared toward the guy who's got some disposable income and says, I want to put $100,000 on some stocks. What should I do? Right? That opened the marketplace up in a way that had never been opened before. And music publishing, we saw parallels to, right? You've got assets. You've got these songs that create royalties and have years and decades even of royalty income that were being done on a B2B basis. Music publishers take entire catalogs and buy them for 7 years. They take a 25% profit and they try to exploit, but they're dealing with other media companies. They're dealing with brands. They're dealing with other B2B, other institutions and companies. They weren't ever dealing with the public. And we saw an opportunity not only for the big publishers and labels to benefit, but from the actual artists themselves to be able to control how much of their IP they want to put up for sale, to set the pricing themselves, to set reversions themselves, and to benefit from a direct connection with the fan that they never really had before. Believe it or not, record labels, iTunes, Spotify, they don't tell you who's buying or streaming or downloading your records ever. If you'd said, hey, I've got 22 million streams last month, well, who are they? Spotify is not going to give you a list of who those people are. We're going to do that. We're going to connect the creator to the consumer in a way that hasn't ever been done before.
I think that this makes a lot of sense, especially if I look at the way that the music business has shifted. I imagine, you know, before Napster, a lot of music discovery was coming through traditional media channels, whether it was Rolling Stone magazine or the radio or television. And that was who was promoting the music and, you know, kind of getting a piece of the pie in the process. Then shift that to the Napster age or the age of people sharing music for free. Suddenly, well, this free component, as we saw with a lot of the indie artists, was making it easier for their music to get discovered. Unfortunately, they weren't making money off of the transaction, but at least they were getting discovered. And it was all thanks to fans sharing that music. So there's this phenomenon that you see oftentimes in music. If you're really into an artist early on, like for me, I wasn't super early, but you know, early aughts, I was into Spoon. And I would go to their show and it would be an amazing show and there wouldn't be too many people there. Then at some point in time, I couldn't go to their shows anymore. They were always sold out. They were too crowded. And you know, you get that kind of sick feeling in the pit of your stomach. I mean, you're happy for the band, but at the same time, you kind of feel like you're kind of missing out on something. And so I've come to realize that looking at Vest, that's because you as an early fan who told your friends about it, who pressured them to listen to the music, you know, you helped make them what they are and you didn't get a piece of the pie. And so I feel like this is filling in that hole that was created when we went to this free model. Does that make sense to you?
David, 100%. I mean, you're basically preaching to the choir. I mean, we say that in our presentation that we're putting back what Napster took away, right? The value to the music was gone when people start sharing these songs by the thousands for free. We're going to show you who wrote the song. We're going to represent songwriter shares from the producer, from the co-writer, from the lyricist, from the bass player, from all the people that came together to make that song something of value, right? And we're going to let them monetize it on their terms, which has never been done before. But you're exactly right. I think, you know, what's happened technologically is amazing. Like I said before, the access to music, the ability to produce it and distribute it is all over the place. What's missing is the component that's most important to the creator is, how do I live from this, right? How do I put food on the table? And that really hasn't been addressed. We think that, you know, the IP portion of it is really the key to it. I mean, it's one thing to do something where you're pledging or you're giving somebody a thank you, or that's all great. And those models have proven very profitable for many people. But we think when you've got skin in the game, when you share and partner in the ownership with the artists themselves, now you're not just a fan, you become an advocate, right? What are you going to share? You're going to share the playlist that you own every song on, or are you going to share a playlist that has no interest to you, no financial interest to you at all? Right. So we think, just like you were saying, instead of just a pat on the back and a thank you, we're going to let you partner with us is a much stronger statement to make than thank you very much for the donation.
And there's also other parts of the monetization stream that I could see this being beneficial to, that feeling of oh, that song is playing and I've known that band since they were just starting, which is that it may still be difficult to monetize music as far as the listening goes. But sometimes, you know, you're watching a Netflix series or you're watching a commercial and all of a sudden this song comes on, which I think is one of the ways that a lot of musicians have supplemented their royalties is by selling rights to their songs to a series or to a podcast. And now when you hear that song, you can have that feeling of, oh, I have a piece of that. You won't have that feeling like you're kind of missing out on something. Is that the case as well?
Of course. And we call it like the Venmo effect, right? People are sharing pictures and receipt pictures of their lunch and how they shared it with somebody, which to me isn't that important personally, but there is an entire generation of people that love to show what they're partnering and what they're involved with. And that type of sentiment, that type of sharing, that type of partnership directly with the artist, we think is where the power comes from in this model. And we think, you know, 80% of the buyers are going to be people that are really big fans of the song and of the artist. And they're going to put anywhere from $5 to $100,000, or probably $5 to $25, a nominal amount of money. They're not so much concerned about the return, or is it a royalty, or is it a master right, or a songwriter right? They just know that I love that song. It's my favorite song. I want to own a little fraction of that song. I'm going to put $10 on it, right? That to me is going to be the biggest portion of our consumer. And I think there will be a portion, the 20% or so, that there is going to be concern about the returns, and they're going to look deeper. They're going to be music professionals. They're going to be soundtrack supervisors, producers, brands, even people that have a stake in the music business and maybe can move the market. They're going to be interested in looking at, you know, the details and, oh, how am I going to make some money with this? And is there a return here? But the bulk of our buyers, I think, are going to buy it to support the songs and artists that they really love.
And Vest is built on blockchain technology. Can you give us a kind of a view of how the music industry worked pre-blockchain and how you envision it working post-blockchain, specifically the way that Vest is working? Like, what is it that Vest does that wouldn't have been possible before the blockchain?
So there's two things. I mean, blockchain is, you know, it's a digital ledger. There's an argument that this could be handled on a ledger that's not blockchain. But I think some of the elements that make blockchain unique are the transparency, the efficiency, the immutability of it. So it's not something that's trivial. It's something that once something's written to it, it can't be unwritten. It's something that's viewable by the public 24/7. And we think some of those attributes are very important with respect to music rights. Prior to blockchain and what exists literally today is a mishmash that's a mess. I mean, you've got PROs, performing rights organizations, in about 140 countries around the world. each one of them is a society that's run slightly different than every other one, right? And some of, in the US, we have four. We have ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, and GMR. Each one of those is run differently. Each one of those offers different payment schemes to each one of its members. It's a mess. And to try to collect, as an example, if you had a song and it played in a bar in Belgium today, chances are you wouldn't see any income on that play for 18 months, 12 to 18 months. Why is that? I don't know, right? In this day and age of digital distribution, I know that song played there. You can track that that song was played in real time. You can track the value of that song in real time. So why shouldn't a payment be made to the creator of that song in real time? That's not happening today. There's somebody that's holding that money for a long period of time. They're benefiting from holding billions of dollars and not reporting it and not delivering it for a long period of time. That's very, very common.
The way I'm imagining it working is that, okay, there's these organizations. I can't remember what you said they were called.
PROs.
Yeah, they're taking the royalties there in Belgium, and then they're eventually passing them on. And then on top of that, they're paying royalties to all these different contributors to the album. And that involves a lot of accounting overhead. Somebody's got to decide how much is owed and everything. And so with blockchain technology, Vesta is built on the Ethereum blockchain, I believe. And so there can be smart contracts so that basically automatically it knows, like, you have this share of these royalties, so this goes to you. And, you know, imagine doing that with thousands or millions of fans with traditional accounting versus some kind of an automated system. It sounds like it would just be so much easier, almost no overhead at all, to distribute the royalties equitably to people according to their contribution, even if that means they're a fan.
That's the goal. And you know, I always say that's what computers are for, right? I mean, people go, well, you're going to cut this into 1,000 pieces and pay 1,000 people. I'm like, well, that's what computers do, right? I mean, if someone's going to run some complex mathematical problem, it behooves you to have an automated system or a computer doing that versus doing it by hand. And there's no real magic. I mean, this is just basic accounting, right? 2 cents comes in over here, 5 cents comes in over here, 10 cents comes in over here. Who does it get paid to, right? That goes, like you said, to the digital ledger. Our hope is that we can build transparency and efficiency into a system that's dark and has been backwards for, you know, 5 decades or more. We want to make it so people can see what they're earning. We want to make it so artists can see where their money's coming from in as real time as possible. Now, is it going to happen when we launch this? No, it's going to happen, you know, probably a few years down the line is my hope. But our goal is to get closer and closer to that every day, right? The more transparent we can get, the better. The more efficient we can get, the better. The closer we can get to real time payments, the better. So if we can add, you know, I don't know, a little incremental increase in any of those factors, we're being of benefit. So our goal is to eventually have real-time payments for artists. And we can see some of that coming in on the digital platforms like YouTube and Spotify and places that track their income and pay monthly. That's much better than being paid every 18 months. But we're going to get there. And the technology is there. There's just no reason not to implement it. We're moving prudently. You know, we don't want to jump ahead 5 steps. People talk about fully decentralized systems. Well, that's nice. But with the way that things are structured and fragmented on the PRO side right now, it's almost impossible. So there's got to be some centralization initially. But as we go through time, you're right. We want to automate this more and more to the point where, you know, those efficiencies are built in and the transparency is right there.
And my response to somebody who said, oh, you're going to pay this to 1,000 people would be, I had the same reaction to, oh, 1,000 or 1,000,000 people are going to promote your music instead of these 5 radio stations, you know? So it only does make sense that this is closing a gap that was created by Napster, just as you said. So I imagine there's a lot of challenges in making this actually feasible and make it happen. When can I go ahead and buy a share of some songs?
So you can actually do that now. Our platform has been live on the web for almost 6 months, but it required you to have a VZT token. And that was, we did a part of our initial raise. We took traditional VC funding. And then we did a coin offering at the late part of last year. And because we have to have a mechanism to allow those coins to turn into song rights, that's been available. But the actual app itself, we're launching in the next, let's call it 60 days. I'm looking at this morning, I got my first, let's call it an alpha, but it's basically a test flight on my phone that I can operate, put a fake credit card in, look at the billing, watch how the accounts and portfolios are structured. We're very close to having it approved by Apple. We hope to launch it within the next 60 days. And we've got a great team. My partner, Robert Menendez, I got to mention, I mean, he's a very deep financial background. He's a quantitative analysis guy out of hedge funds and ran trading floors around the country. He and I together, I think, make a great partnership because I've got the musical background and understand rights and some of the pain points for artists. And he understands trading and how financial markets move and how, you know, people work with investments and how things are split down into different portions and fractions. We've got a lot of guys on the creative side, our CTO's on top. We've got guys on the design side. We're going to make this super easy. Our goal is to make it three swipes to a sale. So it's going to be intuitive. It's going to be something that you can use like Spotify. It's going to be something that is easy for younger people to look at and understand. I mean, one of the challenges we have is, you know, understanding the rights themselves. Most artists don't even understand how their rights work. So we think by a platform like this just being in existence and people starting to use it in small ways helps educate them as to the value and the rights that they actually hold and the rights that they can go after. So it's an exciting time. We're, you know, head over heels. We're opening a South Korean office on Monday because we believe we've got a scale. They've got very deep inroads into K-pop and J-pop and a lot of the Asian markets over there. We got back from a trip through Sweden and France and parts of Europe where we're making partnerships there. And we're talking to people in Africa. There's a huge part of Africa that has no collections mechanisms in place at all. And there's millions of artists there, literally. And they have no way to actually monetize anything. They don't have an ASCAP or BMI in Nigeria, for example. So there are big holes that are left globally in music. We're hoping to provide solutions for many of those. You know, we're doing what we can to get this out as quickly as we can. And we're here for the artists. At the end of the day, my background's in artists management and representation. And I feel for the creators that really haven't been able to monetize, that have been kept away from their consumers by third parties. And our hope is to fix that in ways that we can and to make the payment process and the royalty streams much more transparent and efficient.
Now, what about in the United States? Are these shares of song rights considered a security? Are we buying a stock, or is the SEC involved in this?
It's interesting. We've got, you know, a number of lawyers on our team at this point, and to this point, it doesn't look like it. It looks like royalty based financing, and if you look through that, we're just speaking with an SEC litigator, a former SEC litigator, who's a securities attorney at this point. And he said, you know, royalty-based financing is pretty much exempt from state and federal regulation. So what you're doing here is really that, right? You're giving an artist a certain amount of funding. You're receiving that funding back in terms of royalties over time. So there is no stock. There is no equity being sold directly. It's royalty-based financing in a sense that your income as a buyer is being derived directly from the royalties of the thing that you bought. So it's not considered a security in our attorney's eyes at this point. Music publishers have been doing this for many, many years. They're buying hundreds of catalogs, thousands of catalogs every day. If that were the case, every author of a book, every musician that writes a song, and anybody that offers those manuscripts to 1,000 different publishers or those recordings to 100 different labels would be guilty of offering a security. Right, it can't just be a security at the point where it's sold. It has to be a security, if it is a security, at the point where it's created, and at the point where it's being solicited. And if that were the case, every author of every book would have to be registered with the SEC. Every songwriter in this country would have to be registered with the SEC, and that's not the case.
Great. Well, I hope that turns out so that I can go ahead and buy some shares of some music very, very soon. I really love what you're doing here. I like your strategy. I love to hear that you are thinking about this as kind of an intermediate step towards something a little more decentralized, but obviously you have to work with the industry as it exists right now. So what would you like for our listeners to do to check out what Vest is doing?
If you're interested, go to www.vezt.co and you can sign up to be on our update list. As soon as the app is available, you'll be updated. All you have to do is enter your email and you'll be on our wait list. You can also go to our website at the same place and explore any ISOs, initial song offerings, that are up. We've had, I think, 3 so far, and we've got a hopper loaded up with I think we're going to launch with at least 100. So it's getting there. We're taking meetings with publishers at this point. So our hope is to have 1 million songs on the platform by the end of the year.
Wow.
But if you're interested, check out vezt.co. We'd love to give you more information. Any questions, please reach out to me directly or anybody on our staff.
Sounds great. Steve Stewart, thank you so, so much for coming on the show. Everybody needs to go to vest.co, vezt.co. Thank you so much.
David, thank you. I appreciate it so much. Thanks for having us.
Is Love Your Work helping you find the intersection on your love and money Venn diagram? Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation to make you into the person that you want to be? If so, we, together, you and I, can make this the show that we want it to be. I'm trying to make a nourishing and thoughtful show, and I could use your help with that. Please donate to the show. Just a coffee a month will help support the hosting and production of this show. Just a coffee a month will help spread Love Your Work's message, helping more people live a balanced life with a healthy definition of success. To donate, visit our Patreon page at katavi.net/donate. Patreon is a platform that lets you support creators like me, vote with your dollars, and keep Love Your Work going at katavi.net/donate. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at katavi.net/donate. That's katavi.net/donate. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by our Patreon supporters, such as mini sponsor Roxana Maynard of Agility Alchemist at agilityalchemist.com, and top supporters such as Jeffrey Mason and Vitas Pankovicius. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Katavi. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More, by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Katavi, Inc.